Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Just before we jump into the episode this week, I wanted to share a little bit about the Thrive community that I run. It's a place where many like-minded women go to connect and share their experience with getting and staying successfully sober. There are different sections, like the main Thrive community feed, where people post about things that are up and coming or about challenges they're facing, and they get incredible support from other members of the group. It really is a special, special place to be right now. There are also sections to share your milestones, because every win, even the really small ones, are a big thing to celebrate, and we acknowledge that. There are Thrive events, there are the weekly Zoom recordings, so you can go back and see all the weekly Zoom meetings and all the topics that have been covered in those meetings at your own leisure. There's a share sober tips section, and then there are group chats for the first 30 days, the first 100 days, the first year, and over a year. There's a knowledge hub as well, and in the knowledge hub you'll find a place for books and book recommendations. There's a section of how to survive the first 30 days. So if you come in completely brand new to getting sober, you can hit the ground running and find tools and information to get a structure set up for yourself from the outset. There's also my Thrive Sober program. There's a toolkit. There's understanding the brain science and a space to read and learn about all the topics under emotional sobriety, most of which have been written by myself. So come into Thrive. If you're thinking about it or you're lacking community, I would say just jump in and go for it. And maybe we'll see you in there soon. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm going to be talking to Katrina, and she's from Kilkenny in Ireland, and she's been sober for 10 months. Congratulations, Katrina. Thank you for coming on my show.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'm really looking forward to hearing about the journey. I remember so much the sort of 8, 9, 10 months journey for myself, and how exciting that, you know, year coming around felt at the time. And we were laughing because I was saying, when you get over a year, I just feel like the time flies by and you just don't, you know, you don't really celebrate that much, only just the years that go by at that point. But really, really fab to have your story. I think 10 months is enough for people that are early on in the journey to feel excited, because it's not too far away, but it's also a little bit further in than like 6 weeks. So, you know, you're really going to have some good inspiration and wisdom, I'm sure, to share with the listeners of this show.
I hope so. That's a lot of pressure there.
It is a lot of pressure, isn't it? I didn't mean to do that, actually. That's what happens when I just sort of run away with my thoughts. Yeah. No pressure at all. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are before we go into your story?
Okay, so my name is Katrina. I'm born and bred Irish from Kilkenny in Southeast Ireland. I have two small children, John and Anna Marie. John is 6 years of age and Anna Marie is 3. So two little ones at home. I have a wonderful partner, Kieran, who is the glue that holds us all together. I'm self-employed. I have my own business, which thankfully, in touch wood, at the moment is absolutely thriving. I think every aspect of my life is thriving at the moment. And, you know, being sober is absolutely, without a doubt, it's the reason for it. So that's really me. We're very happy family, busy home life. two small children, birthday parties, all the usual stuff. Work very, very hard, work long hours, but yeah, it's totally worth it. So that's really what I'm about.
Amazing. May I ask, what is your business?
I do remote office administration. So I work for businesses all over Ireland, essentially doing their bookkeeping, doing their record taking, customer service. It's really after taking off now in the last, I suppose, in the last year or 2 years. But it's thriving at the moment now. Ever since, you know, COVID was terrible. The only silver lining from COVID was that people had to work from home, and businesses like my own that work on a remote basis really got an absolute kickstart. So if there was ever any sort of a silver lining to be taken from that, from a business perspective, that's what it did. It did for my business.
Oh, great. Oh, congratulations. No mean feat, you know, having your own business.
No,
all that, especially with a young family. So yeah, good.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's go back to the beginning. Talk to me about your life with alcohol. What did that look like?
In a word, I was thinking about this a lot earlier on. There's a lot of words that I could use to describe my life with alcohol. I started drinking when I was, I had my first experience with alcohol at 16. Same as a lot of people, a local disco, drank cider, got sick, all of that sort of nasty stuff. Throughout school, I didn't really drink in school as such, but once I hit college, or what would be university in the UK, definitely I drank to be more confident and to talk to people. I wouldn't say I wasn't a shy person, but certainly feelings of inadequacy, very conscious of myself, but drink just removed all of that. I was well able to talk to anybody and their dog. Loved that feeling, that freedom of being able to engage with whoever was in front of me. But certainly my life with alcohol in the more recent years, very, very dark, very, very unhappy, and lonely, I think, is the biggest word that I would use. It was so lonely in the end. It turned into a full-blown addiction. There's no question about it. I listen to some of the podcasts, and there's ladies that come on, and men, of course, as well. Ladies particularly that come on and say, well, I kind of knew I had a problem because I would go out on the weekend and I would binge. And then, you know, I wouldn't drink anything until the following weekend and then I would binge. I wasn't that drinker. I was every night. I went to the point of hiding it, putting my family at risk, putting myself at risk. It got incredibly dark. And during that, the really nuts and bolts of that addiction, it was loneliness, pure loneliness. I couldn't, because the shame stopped me from telling anybody how bad it had actually gotten. We were talking about shame, obviously, that's just a huge part of it. So certainly the recent years, when in university I would have used it as a crutch to talk to people, it became more of a crutch to actually live. My children, thankfully, like through the pregnancies of both of my children, I didn't drink, which is one thing that I suppose out of the whole disaster, I can say I didn't drink while I was pregnant with them. But as soon as I had given birth, that was it. I was straight back on it again. And I can't even remember. And it's funny, if you speak to people who would have been, we'll say, as bad as me, if you want to use that term, a lot of them will say that they can't remember when it changed from being, I can remember being a social drinker and having great nights out, getting drunk, no question about it. I always went too far. There was I'm even kind of thinking more about it now as I'm speaking, and I always pushed it too far. Than everybody else in the group, whether I would be with my family or whether I would be with a group of friends, I always went too far with it. When I started drinking at home before it became a problem per se, I would still drink too much at home. So while some people would talk about, oh, I have to have a glass of wine every night, I was never a glass of wine. I was a bottle of wine. I was two bottles of wine. And at my worst, I was three bottles of wine. That was when I was openly drinking, in the sense that people could see me drinking. When I started to hide it, and I can't remember the first time I hid a drink. I literally cannot remember. And I've tried to remember, when was that first moment that I kind of thought, right, I'm gonna hide this. I used to hide it under the kitchen sink. Like, this is the you talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. This is the ugly. Mm. I can't remember when I started doing that, but I could remember having openly a glass of wine in front of my partner, but I would have a glass of vodka under the sink. And then I think as time progressed, he obviously knew I was drinking too much, and it became more of a conversation at that stage. He could see the problems. He could see the problems starting to occur. And of course, on the face of it, oh, I'm so sorry. What did I say last night? I'm so sorry for that. I won't drink again. And then I just wouldn't have the glass of wine openly. I would have my glass of vodka under the sink. So it slowly progressed into that hidden addiction, which I think personally is far more dangerous than anything you're going to do in front of people. So it got really lonely. It got really, really lonely. There wasn't anybody that I could tell, or that I was comfortable enough with telling, because I'm very close to my mother. I couldn't tell her because of the fear of the disappointment that she would have in me. My sister is great. I couldn't tell her because she can have a glass of wine and just leave it at that. But she, I wouldn't want anybody to be worrying about me. That was the thing. I wanted to be left alone to drink. You know, it's so bizarre when you say it, when you put it into words now, you're like, how did I feel that way? But I really did. I wanted to be left alone in my addiction. And it was every single morning I was sick, every morning without fail. Sick all the time. And you know that old, I think, I don't know if it's an AA saying or whether it's, you know, you got sick and tired of being sick and tired. Like, I was the epitome of sick and tired 24/7. So that's how bad it got, and just the volume of alcohol. I'm really lucky. I'm 43 years of age. I'm really, really lucky that I did not do any permanent damage.
Yeah.
And I didn't. So there has to be somebody looking after me somewhere because, God, I pushed every boundary. But no, I didn't do any permanent damage. And it was my life with alcohol, lonely.
Yeah. Which is sad, isn't it? You know, it's...
Oh, really? Yeah, absolutely.
Really, do you think that there was a loneliness before the alcohol made you really lonely? Or did it after?
I think the loneliness was hand in hand with feeling inadequate.
Yeah.
And it's a real big way of putting it that I felt inadequate. But I think, like, if you really root down into your feelings, I always felt lesser, mm-hmm. whether it be that I wasn't as funny, I wasn't as strong, I wasn't as amusing, I wasn't as good a friend. I was it just all comes back to a confidence thing, and the alcohol gave me the boost, but it completely backfired in me, because in the beginning, when I was using alcohol to be more confident and to be more, in my head, I was being more, it then turned on me because it got to the point where it became such a habit. And it is, a lot of it is habit. It became such a habit, I just couldn't stop. I'm so jealous of people that can go out and just have a glass of wine with their meal and move on. I was never that person.
Yes.
They do say about alcoholics, you know, we do things and we do it 150% regardless of what it is.
You know what?
I gave it a good lash.
I'm convinced that that's ADHD now as well, because I do. It's the same for me with ADHD. It's like, I'm just so all or nothing with everything.
Yes. Like, yeah, exactly.
If I'm going to learn about something, I will learn to a degree level. I just can't.
Yes. Absolutely. You become an expert. Yeah.
I get annoying with it, to be honest, but I quite like it myself now. But, you know, your story echoes so many people's story, in that there is that inner feeling, that like inner vibe that you're just not good enough for whatever reason. And isn't it just so sad that so many of us, for whatever reason, have grown up feeling so disempowered that we have to get, and I'm talking, I can't really perhaps talk on behalf of men here as a woman, and working with so many women over the last few years, I see this story play out over and over again. So I can kind of confidently assess that a lot of women grow up with those feelings of inadequacy, and it's sort of like
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because it's almost like, where does that come from? Why did that happen? Why are we all having this shared experience of...
It's really weird. I've gone through therapy. I've gone through, we'll say, counselling sessions. And you kind of, you look at, we'll say, you look at, where did I grow up? You look at my parents. You look at the familial structure. Mm-hmm. And my parents were fantastic. They're still fantastic. Yeah. My family are fantastic. I cannot say that they didn't do anything wrong. I think some people are just born that way. I really do. I don't think it all has to do with childhood trauma. You hear a lot of people talking about childhood trauma, which happens so often. Mm. I go back through my childhood. I'm trying to find, because the kind of person that I am, I look for a logical reason. If I'm feeling down, I'm like, okay, what's wrong with me today? You have to try and find that logical reason, yeah, or else you void your feeling. You think, oh, well, I shouldn't be feeling like that. And I've gone back in my history to try and find what happened. Nothing did. I was just born that way. And my go-to was alcohol. I had a moment of awakening, I suppose, quite recently. And I don't even know what brought it on. I was talking to somebody about the fact that I was coming on 10 months. And I said, I had a really long think about my life, was say from university through my early adult life through to where I'm at now. And I can honestly say every single problem that I ever had, whatever the problem was, whether I fell out with a friend or whether I lost a job or whether, you know, whatever the problem was, in some way I can link it to alcohol. Mm. Every single problem. And that's some moment of clarity when you look back and you think, you know, that's where you could potentially just start regretting everything. And you have to make the mental decision not to regret everything and think, well, look, I'm here now because of what's happened in the past. But every single problem that I ever had in some way, shape or form is down to alcohol.
It's a powerful thing, I think, to reconcile that. And actually, I would say, again, having, you know, worked with many women, I think that's a realization that sometimes it's almost like the last stop on the train line. People eliminate things from their life before they eliminate alcohol as kind of the root cause of why things are going wrong every 5 minutes or why they're not feeling great. You know, alcohol, bizarrely, is like one of the last things that we eradicate, whether that's because we don't see it genuinely, sounds like maybe that was like that for you, or whether it was a little bit of denial. I think for me, I knew alcohol was causing problems, I just didn't want to face it. So it was slightly different for me, but still the same kind of trajectory that eventually alcohol was the thing that ended up being the thing that was making everything go wrong in my life. Sometimes, I don't know if you have exposure to this, but sometimes I notice that people in my life, they are struggling and they're not connecting the dots that alcohol might be the issue. And that's also challenging as well, because people, I think, are on their own journey. And sometimes I think it's important that you do come to your own conclusions about your own life. Some people can't be told, you know, do this, do that, or maybe it's this, or maybe it's that. But it's just fascinating, I find. It's fascinating that alcohol is just held in so much prestige in a way. It just gets away with murder, literally. And it's like the last thing we realise might be the issue. So it's great that you have got there, I think. You know, it's really positive. Even if it took a long time, which I guess...
Oh, it took a very, very long time. It took a very long time. I have a friend as well, and he's sober off 30-something years. He's one of the, we would call them the old-timers. I remember him saying to me after one of my many, many, many relapses, I don't know what to say to you, kid, was how we started it. And I was hungover and emotional and the whole lot. He said, you're standing on a cliff edge, but you don't know where that cliff edge is. You don't know, have you got one or two more relapses left before you fall? And again, in AA, I'm not in AA, you know, on a regular basis, but I did go to AA many years ago, and some of the stuff out of it is really poignant. You're on that cliff edge. You don't know how many relapses you've got left before you fall. And in AA, they talk about the yets. So I haven't lost my family yet. I haven't lost my children yet. I haven't lost my business yet. So everything is there. It's like it's hanging in front of you. And the cliff edge thing. It's like you said, the last stop on the train. You never really know when you're going to, when that straw that breaks the final camel's back is going to kick in. And I was just really lucky that I never got there. Yeah. But I'd say I'm pretty sure I danced on that cliff edge a few times. Mm. We'll never know. Hopefully we'll never know how close I actually was to. It's probably, I don't want to compare myself to anybody else, but I did. I told my family I was going to do this podcast, and I've listened to all of them, and some of them, I don't want to appear like I'm way darker than everybody else. But I think in terms of, we'll say, how far I pushed it, I pushed it to full on. I would have lost my family. I would have lost my business. And what I do say to everybody else is that the depression and the anxiety that I was suffering from when I was drinking, if I had not stopped, I honestly do think I probably wouldn't be here today. And that's maybe, I don't know, should we say trigger warning or something like that, that it really does, you know, it was going to kill me in one way or another. It was going to kill me. It got so, so serious, and so I was so deep in it.
Yeah. It must be a difficult thing to reflect on that now, you know, having come so far. And you know, when we started our conversation before we clicked record, it was so positive, you know, the changes that you've made, and I'm sure we will explore, you know, the feelings, you know, life is good for you. Life is really good. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. Does it ever overwhelm you sometimes thinking about, God, if it had gone in that direction, which it could have easily gone.
Could have easily done. Yeah. It doesn't overwhelm me. What it does, I remind myself, not all the time, but I do remind myself about how bad I was, because and you know what? You can give yourself a massive clap on the back because of the progress that you've made and the progress that I've made. And like I said to you before this started, you know, you were asking me about, is it okay to use your name and stuff like that? It's only now that I'm kind of thinking, you know, I don't care who hears this. If it helps some, you know, if it helps somebody, then it's job done. If somebody who knows me hears this, I'll tell them the story just the same as that I'm telling you now. There's no shame in it, because now I'm just so proud of where I've come to from being so low. You know, it's amazing. I had a moment a few weeks ago. This is just a really tiny example of where you kind of congratulate on your progress and some of the weird incidents that you'll have. We went and we ate dinner in a restaurant recently, and something was wrong with the food. Next day, not feeling well, just really, tummy was upset, just wasn't feeling well. Got myself together, had my cup of tea, went out to work, and started to feel better as the day went on. And the only thing that I could think about in the car was, my God, isn't it great to be feeling unwell, but that it isn't self-induced? Yeah. Do you know that it was actually something really genuine, and only somebody who kind of went as low as I did would actually see kind of the humor in the fact that you're kind of thinking, oh, sure, it's only a tummy upset. It's not a hangover. Isn't it fantastic? That's as high as the bar goes. It's not, you're not hungover, you're good.
I love that. So what a reframe. That's brilliant.
You get the silver lining in everything. Yeah.
You do. Actually, that's really interesting, because I feel like that a lot of the time now. I feel very much like I can turn something negative, let's say, or challenging into something of strength or something more positive or something uplifting. It doesn't always happen overnight, you know, like recently I went through something that hit my family. It was quite big. And I have to say, I felt very challenged and quite stuck for a month, 2-3 months. But I realized that I came out the other side and there was so much to feel grateful for. And I think that mindset, a lot of that mindset has been born out of this process of stopping something that was really hard to stop, that was damaging me and kind of a bit ruining my life, and getting through all the challenges that brought, all the early sobriety and all the things that I had to, you know, the FOMO and all the things you have to navigate, and just that constant feeling of strength that you build as you walk through your sobriety, like, you know, and you get to year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, for me soon 6, it just brings so much emotional resilience, I think, this whole process.
Without a doubt.
I now reflect and think, I wouldn't have not wanted to go through all of this in my life. I wouldn't have wanted to live my life without this issue with alcohol that I then got over. Because I don't know if it would colour my life in the way that it does today.
Yeah. Oh, it's again, like just what you've said, like you go through the crap in order to get to the really good stuff. And you know, it's very easy to go the other way. Like when you look back on your past actions, it's very easy to slip into that. Oh God, you know, if I had given up 10 years earlier, if I had had this moment of clarity 10 years earlier, you know, I would have had 10 better years. But then you really have to just put that back in its box and kind of say, look, this is where we've gotten to now. And it is, it's actually, I think, a lot to do with retraining your brain and retraining your mind. You can be that negative person. You can. But if you take control of that feeling, kind of say, right, well, if you look at everything that's happening in your life, you can find a silver lining. Things can always be worse, which is sometimes you look at that as being the silver lining. But you can take goodness from everything. You can take joy from everything, but you've got to retrain your brain in order to do that. And I think that's the biggest moment of reckoning that I've had, or moment of awakening that I've had, is trying to find the good in every single day, in every single circumstance.
Yeah, it's a great practice to get into, and like you say, it's something that you have to build. It's not, you don't stop drinking and then suddenly open up that emotional toolbox and there's your 15 tools all lined up perfectly in order. You have to learn that stuff. You have to build them yourself. But that can be the overwhelming thing, I think, in early sobriety, is, you know, I don't know how to handle anything. I don't know how to sort of deal with challenges and how to navigate. But you do get better and stronger and more resilient, and it just starts to flow, I think. And that feeling doesn't go away. Like, you're 10 months, I'm nearly 6 years. I'm still learning so much about my own emotional resilience and my own limitless capabilities and my own silver linings and the way that my mind, the way that I'm crafting my mindset. It's a conscious thing. You have to choose to reframe, to find opportunity in things. I think that is a practice. It is a practice. It's a daily practice. And it's not always perfect. You know, there are many times that I can feel sorry for myself.
And just We all can.
For me. But actually, you can then catch yourself out doing that. And then say, well, hang on a minute, do I really like this narrative? No, actually, I don't like this narrative. I want to think about this in a different way. And that will only improve your life overall, doing that. So let's talk about what happened during the sort of days leading up to you stopping. What made that huge change for you happen?
So I had tried to give up on a number of occasions. It just wasn't working, and it was becoming farcical. You know, you'd make the same promises over and over again. You'd break the same promises over and over again. And it got to a point where I knew my counselor was saying that really, really and truly in-house treatment was what I would have to look at. Because of the relapses and their frequency, really. So that was the first, I looked at her as if she had 40 heads when she said, would I consider in-house treatment? Like, me? I've got the two kids at home. What are you talking about? And she kind of put it to me. She said, what kind of a life do you think you're giving to them? You know, which is the better option?
Yeah.
So that was really, I think, my subconscious was keeping me in the dark about how serious it actually was. My friend kept saying that cliff edge is close, that cliff edge is close. But I think I kept skirting around it and kind of thinking, you know, my partner, who's just the most patient man in the world, I'm sure he'll never leave me. God, why would he leave me? He loves me. And there was that sort of, I kind of convinced myself that things wouldn't change. But when she mentioned in-house, and I had discussions with friends and family about it as well, they knew how bad it had gotten at this stage, albeit they'll probably discover, you know, something new. They'll come into my house the next day and they'll check under the sink. But, you know, it's they knew how bad it had gotten when they all kind of were fairly adamant that it, like, Katrina, this is really serious. This is not... we're not joking here. We're not over dramatizing how bad this is. That's the point where I decided to go and see my GP. Went into the GP, who was just, oh my goodness, he's just the loveliest, loveliest man ever. And I explained to him where I was at, and I had been to him a few times before. So what we agreed was, I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this on the podcast, but I'll just put it out there. I went on a substance called Antabuse. Mm. Antabuse is a medication that people take, which thankfully I haven't seen it in action. But basically, if you drink alcohol while you're taking Antabuse, it will make you incredibly ill. And not just vomit ill, but it could, you know, damage your blood pressure and stuff like that. So you really don't want to have a drink while you're on Antabuse. And I remember the GP, he said, you know, most people, he said, you know, Antabuse, we don't have a huge amount of faith in it, because if you're going to drink, you just stop taking it and you're going to drink. But I got the prescription, and I don't know whether it's the right word, that it was a miracle drug for me, in the sense that I started taking Antabuse and it was like something in my brain just clicked. I religiously took, and still am taking, I'm still on Antabuse, one tablet every night. Thankfully, I had no side effects. Again, before you ever go looking for this, you consult your GP, etc. But I never had any side effects. The only thing is, and it just goes to show what a psychological addiction I had as opposed to a physical addiction, I did not have any withdrawal. But once I started taking that tablet, it was like somebody had just taken the option away from me. Mm-hmm. I did have, when I say cravings in the first few weeks, it wasn't physical cravings. Thankfully I wasn't in a corner, you know, shaking or, you know, nauseous. You hear about all of these withdrawal symptoms. I had very few of those. Mine was pure psychological. It was my routine. My routine was, you come home in the evening, you fill that glass with vodka, and you chug it. Like, that was, again, it wasn't to enjoy it. It was to chug it and get that sort of sense of oblivion. Mm. That was, and it's very strange to say that was what I missed, but it was initially, that was what I missed. Mm. But I got through the first few weeks. They were very tough. And the main thing that I did was I spoke to somebody every time I felt like that. And even if they couldn't really quite understand what I was about, again, my partner, I told him every time I was feeling some sort of a craving, if you want to call it that, and making him aware of it, it helped. It's just, you offload it and it's gone. And you kind of think, well, I'm not going to be drinking tonight. So it kind of goes back to the one day at a time thing. Got over the first few weeks, and then I just started to sail. I just started to fly. I had very few cravings. Like I said, no physical cravings. It was all thought processes, and I just had to change what I was doing in the evening times. You know, I had to change my life, I suppose, my routines, and I did. The, you know, the day that I went for the GP visit where I got the Antabuse, I think at that moment, if the question was, you know, what was it that made me stop? It was realizing how serious I had allowed this to get. But then it was definitely, I started to think way more about my children and the impact that I was going to have on them. Every mother will say, you know, your children, they're your life. That's why we exist. After we have children, that's why we exist. Everything we do is for them. And it didn't matter how hard I was working. It didn't matter how nice I was, how much I spoiled them, how many toys I bought them, how many cuddles I gave them. If I was still drinking, I was doing them a disservice. Simple as that. So That was what made me go to the GP. I'm just one of the really lucky ones that found that mechanism to stop. Mm. And Antaboos was the mechanism to stop. And I've had people who said, you know, well, you better be careful now. You're replacing one addiction with another. You're going to get addicted to these. I kind of say, no, I mean, you have to put it into its box. A lot of people get addicted to AA meetings, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. They get addicted to Quitlet. They get addicted to, they go to the gym and suddenly they're in the gym 24/7. They replace one addiction with another. Antaboos for me, or we'll say call it medication for me, has been the method that I've used to get to my 10 months. And I will at some point decide, right, I'm not going to take those anymore. Thankfully, there is no long-term effects or anything like that. But that is the mechanism that I found worked for me.
Yeah.
And I guarantee even if I got placebos now, it would still do the same thing. Yeah. I'm just, that it is mental. It's pure mental. Yeah. And that's what made me stop.
Oh, it's amazing. It's so funny. I've just been reading about placebos as well. The whole placebo thing is fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. That they've done. But yeah, I mean, look, you found something that worked for you. That's all that matters, right?
Yeah.
That's all that matters. And it sounds like what this gave you is an opportunity for space to implement other things, right? It's not, funnily enough, it's a pill, but it won't really be the magic pill. Like, it will also be all the things that you have applied for yourself, the getting through those early days, the sharing with your partner, the ups and downs and sharing with other people, the changing your routines, you know, listening yep. to the podcast, doing the books, all the bits and bobs creates a holistic framework. Yep. And all of those things together make the difference, as well as
yep.
you having that thing, whatever it was that unlocked that door, whether it was that medication or something else, it clicked for you, right? And
yep.
that stuff is what makes the success, which is amazing.
Yep.
And yeah, like, if it's working for you, that's perfect. And you don't, you know, there's no, you will know as and when you get to that point where you think, well, maybe I won't, you know, do that anymore. But it's the same as, maybe I don't need to listen to podcasts every day anymore. Maybe
exactly, exactly, yeah.
every day anymore. Maybe I can run yeah. and do, you know, maybe you will replace the medication with a strong string of supplements or something, you know, and do you know what I mean? So you've taken ownership of your health. And that's the most important thing. And where you are today, yeah. which is a really positive place, you know, that's,
yeah.
that speaks volumes. It just shows you what you've done is right for you. And I'm a huge advocate for doing what you think is right for you. I there is no one way. There is no
absolutely.
There's no M road that goes through. Everybody has to find their way through, you know, and
yeah.
Somebody listening to this might spark an interest in them. They might really relate to your story and think, well, this might work for me, and that might be the thing that works for them. And then fantastic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So talk to me about those early days then. So what sort of things did you do to support yourself, particularly in that first kind of 100 days?
So the main thing that I did was I was talking a lot more. So, again, my mother is very, my mother and father, I was talking to them every day in terms of how I was feeling, you know, because you're really fragile, I think, in the first, particularly the first month, you're really fragile. You are, like a lot of people say, you know, you're feeling all the feelings that you have numbed up until then. So I was very fragile. And while I was really lucky to escape physical withdrawals, certainly in terms of headspace, the biggest thing was feeling all of those feelings. And what I found was when I was drinking, it was a mad rush to get home to drink. Mm. But when you removed the drink, there was no mad rush to get home, if that makes sense. So I had to redesign, re-engineer every evening. And it was at that point, very early in the whole thing, that I rediscovered the joy of my children, I suppose, and the joy of having a comfortable home, where I wasn't spoiling it with vodka every evening. I was actually enjoying them far more. And very, very quickly within the first few days, it started to turn into something different, where I was going home and I was cooking something different for dinner, and I was going to, you know, read them another book that I had bought and stuff like that. It really was, I think, a lot of it was taking control over where you want your focus to go as well, because obviously I had spent so much energy trying to hide and indulge in this addiction, so much energy, like your entire brain. It doesn't think about anything else, about where am I going to buy the next bottle from? Which shop am I going to stop at on the way home? Okay, I need to pick up. So, you know, I have to pick up John from school. I'm going to bring him back. There's so much energy that goes into engineering the whole thing for you to be able to hide a drink. Yeah. So it was taking all of that energy and re-engineering that into something different, where, okay, well, I'm going to go home this evening really fast. I'm going to cook a really quick dinner because I want to have an hour to spend with John on a certain book. Or I'm going to put on a movie and we're going to have movie night. And it was really just like, God, like a baby deer, like a fawn going out on really shaky legs. It's kind of, you're rediscovering all this stuff that you had at your fingertips, but you couldn't see it. And I liken it, the way that I like to describe it to people, it's like looking through, do you remember those old bathrooms where they used to have the frosted glass, you know, that plastic that people used to put over their bathroom windows? It was like looking at life or experiencing life through that. It was translucent. So you could only see figures. You couldn't see anything clearly. And that's the way I would describe my life then to my life now. Now I can see everything clearly. There is no, it's not translucent. It's now transparent and I can see everything with clarity. When I was in my addiction and when I was drinking, it was, nothing was clear. Nothing was sharp. My brain wasn't sharp. My thinking wasn't sharp. And it was really a total rediscovery of, geez, I'm even like, this is, none of this was planned to come out now, and it's only coming out of my brain now is the more I'm
love
talking.
It.
It was a total rediscovery of my entire life.
Yeah.
Two beautiful children, two healthy, intelligent children that would run rings around you. The two of them are so clever. And getting to rediscover enjoying time with them and my partner. That's what happened within the first 100 days. It was a rediscovery of my life.
I love that. I remembered, I saw a quote when I was early on in my journey, maybe I was 100 or 200 days into my journey. And it always really stuck with me, because obviously, especially in the kind of like more alcoholic label community, identify, you know, as alcoholics, and they talk about that openly. They talk about being in recovery and they talk about being in recovery for life. But for me, I never really overly resonated with that. I didn't like the limitation of that thought that I was always in recovery, that I would never get, it's almost like I could never get past it. So yeah. I always liked being in rediscovery, not recovery. Mm. That was the way I framed it for me. And it's like, I love how many times you use that word rediscovery, because that is what it's like. And it's so simple. It's like rediscovering the simple joy, like the micro moments of joy in life that get very fuzzy and very dulled down by this constant over.
You miss them.
Yeah. You do miss them. And I think when you've been drinking for a long time, I don't know if you ever really noticed them in the first place. Like, I don't know if you were really tuned into it. If you're drinking since you were 14, 15, 16 in your case, and alcohol was always part of the picture, going out and doing, you know, just it was just part of weekly life, eventually became part of daily life. I don't think you do really tune into those micro moments and how special they can be, but they are there. And when you do stop drinking and you just sort of like the wipers go on almost on your eyes, like you say, everything becomes a little bit more clear and sharper, more in focus. Those little moments feel great. And that's, I think they bring a lot of joy, those moments.
There's certain changes have happened, like definitely rediscovery of my home life. I mean, even little things now just that are popping into my head as you're talking, you know, little changes that have happened in the house. I mean, I would honestly say that while I was drinking, would I have called my house a happy house? I know my children were fed, bathed, you know, they were looked after. And they were loved. They were always loved. And I've never, thankfully, I've never slapped one of my children or anything like that. There's nothing, they haven't ever been abused. You know, you hear about really serious, serious situations where somebody would have to live with the guilt of doing something like that in their addiction. I didn't, again, that was one of the yets. I never got to that, but you never know further down the road what could have happened. But now, like my little boy is six and he's just super intelligent. And he's gotten into the habit the last few months. And funnily enough, it's kind of, I'm realizing now it's kind of coincided with around the time that I gave up alcohol. He gets in to bed with, you know, myself and my partner every night in between us. And he sleeps in his own bed, but he gets in every single night and he comes in for a cuddle. That's what he wants to come in for. And I think that's definitely part of the, if you want to call it the recovery process. I'm a different person and I think he wants to be closer to me now because I'm not drinking anymore. That's just one of the little signs that he's probably more relaxed with me. He's probably happier. He's probably feeling more loved. He's certainly getting more attention because regardless of what you say, you can, as a drinker, you can try and convince yourself that you're still doing everything you should be doing, but you're not. If you're honest with yourself, you're not. If you're not fully there and fully present, that child will know it. They will know it. They may not know it right now, but they will know it in years to come when they think back on their relationship with their parent. And that's not no shade on anybody who's still in their addiction. That is just for me. I'm just thanking my lucky stars. And I consider myself incredibly lucky that I've managed to come out of it now. And I can see the difference. The difference in 10 months alone is monumental.
What would you say have been the kind of more challenging parts of this journey for you? What's been the stuff that you've had to really kind of hunker down and work on?
Definitely, I think it was routine. The routine that I had to change. When I actually think back on it, we'll say my drinking, and I say once it became hidden, like it wasn't very well hidden, but we'll call it hidden. That went on for a really long time. The hardest part was redesigning and re-engineering the evenings to take that out. It was finding things to do instead of drinking. But the hardest part, I'm trying to think what was the hardest part. I suppose if I'm asked that now, it is having conversations about how bad it got. I had a recent conversation with my partner, and he's a very, very quiet man. But I had read a book by an author that's quite, you come across him quite frequently on TikTok, and his wife was a severe alcoholic and she died from alcoholism. And I remember getting to the end of the book and I said something to my partner and he said something like, well, you did that. And we started into this conversation, which I don't think I wasn't expecting and I wasn't really emotionally ready for. And I think the hardest part is probably dealing with the things that you did. When I say dealing with, like, I mean, I remember he told me at one stage that John did say, why does mummy shout so much? That, I mean, just hearing that, I could feel my heart contracting. The thoughts of actually hurting his feelings, I can't handle it at all. So I think the hardest part is not giving up. The hardest part is actually making peace, I suppose, with everything that you did while you were a drinker. That wasn't me, even though it was me. It wasn't me. I adore my children beyond words, and I would never hurt them deliberately. But to know that I did, that's a big eye opener. That's a, you know, it's very humbling, I suppose, to be told. You know, there was a lot of things that happened, just messy evenings where I'd have a fall and stuff, and like the combination of kind of going back to that and knowing that you can't erase that from anyone's memory. You can't erase it from your own. You can't erase it from everybody else's. So it's making peace with the fact that I was a horrendous person when I was drinking. There's no question about it. I was horrendous. And just trying to make peace with that and kind of being at peace with the notion that everybody around you, while they will forgive you, they don't forget. So you just have to kind of keep You have to keep going with that. That's probably the hardest part. I'd love to be able to go into everybody's brain like they do in Men in Black and click, and those memories are gone, you know. But no, that's never going to happen. They will always remember. Thankfully, I think John is young enough that he will forget, will say, what I would have been like.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just have to take it. And that's part of the, you know, making peace with it. Let's move on. I'm here for a reason. And it's because of all of that that I'm here and I'm so strong in what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. So you have to try and find that silver lining, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that the shame piece is a difficult piece. We talked about this before we came online, didn't we? It is like a big, heavy rucksack of shame bricks on your back that you carry on for a while. And it's something that needs processing. And I think you have to find forgiveness for yourself. I always felt like with my own shame rucksack, I always felt like that wasn't really me. As a drinker, that wasn't really who I inherently was. And the alcohol did change me and it did make me behave differently. And I was the one that drank the drink and you can argue that, you know, they were my decisions. But a lot of the time, my drinking, I think, was because I was trying to feel better. About things, about breakups,
trying to self-medicate.
Yeah, just feel better. Pressures of life, disappointments, not getting things not going the way that I thought they might. And just having that, you know, knowing that the brain doesn't mature until your mid, late 20s for a start, and how much alcohol damages that brain maturity as well. It from a young age, you're so much more susceptible to having issues with alcohol when you're older, you know, which does make sense now, but that stuff was not very well known shared. I didn't learn anything about alcohol when I was a kid. All I learned was that, or a teenager, is that I want to do that to fit in, and makes me feel good. It's fun and all this stuff. So I think that, being able to reconcile some of that stuff is really important for just sort of taking that rucksack off and looking at it, processing it, accepting it, forgiving yourself for it, and then put it in the cupboard because that bit of your life has gone. But interestingly, I do believe it does shape where we are today. And so it's a weird thing, isn't it? It's sort of like, was part of your life. Some things were embarrassing. I've definitely done things I wish I hadn't. But then equally, had I not done them, I wouldn't have felt really bad. And if I hadn't felt really bad, I might not have, gone on this journey. I could still be drinking. And so, it's life, isn't it? I think human life is imperfect. And
absolutely.
Accepting the bits about yourself that are good and the bits about you that, you know, weren't so good, but that you're improving now. And I think that's the important thing. So in terms of your biggest gains then, what have been, like, how has sobriety changed your life?
Oh my God, where do I start? It's changed me. It's changed me. I am so different. I think somebody said to me recently, they kind of chuckled at me and said, my God, you're really living your best life. And I actually am, you know, cliche as that sounds. Down to, you know, getting up in the morning and not being that sick and tired feeling, you know, you're feeling peppy, not feeling peppy all the time now, and not to the point of being annoying, but yeah, I'm peppier than I ever was. My business has completely taken off. I've been, my career, I think, in the last 10 months, what I've jammed into my career, it's just been an absolute acceleration. I'm asked to speak on speaking panels and stuff like that now. And like, none of that would have ever happened while I was drinking, ever. The gains that I've had with my family, the trust that I've managed to build up again, finally, after breaking their trust, God knows how many times. You know, at one stage, somebody said it was double digits, you know, in terms of the times I said, I promise I won't do it again. And I did it again. So it's, you know, the trust that I've built up. And just, I think the biggest gain for me has been, it has been clarity. It's having a really clear vision on what my capabilities are and having a really clear vision on how much alcohol was affecting me. Because I don't think you don't let your brain go there when you're drinking. You don't think about the bad stuff. You think about the immediate future. You think, okay, well, if I drink this last drop, how sick will I be in the morning? Or how many meetings will I need to reschedule in the morning to accommodate my fogginess and accommodate my laziness? Mm-hmm. But the clarity to be able to know how much you've got in you. I've found skill sets that I knew were there. I have to say, I knew were there. I can be a really good public speaker. I can be a really good trainer and stuff like that. You know, I always had that ability, but I never ran with it in the way that I've run with it now. And talking to my mum recently, can't even remember what, I think it was when I mentioned I was doing the podcast, and she said, my God, it's a testament to how far this time you've come. And I said, now I actually feel in this particular period of sobriety, no period of sobriety has ever felt like this for me, ever. It's just, and now the thoughts of relapsing is just so far away. It's like, you know, I thought I had a lot to lose before. I've got so much to lose now, because now I've built those relationships. Like, again, with my children, I've built that trust with my children. They know me inside out. And if I was to go back drinking again, they would lose their mother. Mm-hmm. Do you know, they would lose me.
Yeah.
So I would lose in the whole thing. I'm sounding very negative about it, but I suppose you have to think about what the negative impact would be. You know, the biggest gain is clarity. I am me, and I'm really good at what I do, and I have a really happy family, and I'm responsible for that. Mm. That's the positive, and that's what I would stand to lose if I ever went down that road again. So I will never go down that road again.
Okay. And also as well, I think it's that reflection of what would you gain going down that road again anyway?
Like, this is it. This is it. Nothing.
Nothing down there. Like.
No. It's a black hole. It's a vacuum.
Yeah.
It's a vacuum.
And how has it changed the relationship with yourself?
Oh, with myself. I think that's where my confidence levels, I don't feel inadequate anymore. I do from time to time. Like, I think everybody does. You know, no matter how confident you can be and how good you are at something, you know, there's always maybe a little element of self-doubt. But I think, what's that cliche again? Jump and what is it? Think and jump anyway, you know, or try it. And it's like, I just go ahead and I do it. If it fails, it's going to fail. I've really got this sort of nonchalance around doing new things now, and not even doing new things, like with the business and stuff. I've taken on clients that I never thought I'd be capable of taking on. I've got a lot more about me in terms of a lot more honest with people, you know. It's really hard to describe. You just have a new honesty about you, where you're just thinking, well, look, this is me. Just take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Feel the fear and do it anyway. Is that that's what, yes, I was trying to think of, you know? Yes. You know, yes. Whereas I was like a scared mouse. I was scared of everything when I was drinking. And again, scared of everything. Scared of waking up in the morning. Scared of going to work. You'd have a constant fear of, is somebody going to catch me by surprise with a request? You had constant imposter syndrome. And now that I've got this spout of sobriety, I'm kind of like, my God, I'm really doing this, and I'm really doing this well. And I'm getting that confidence from other places and not alcohol. And I think, and it's a really healthy way of living.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, that thing around being able to self-validate, I think that's a really big thing. That's a really big thing. And I think that's a big thing to come into, feeling that inner confidence grow and validating yourself, not needing that external validation as much.
Yeah. It's building that foundation on the person that was always there.
Yeah,
but just definitely. when we take the alcohol away, that person is there and vulnerable, and it's nurturing that person. And like you said, you can sound a little bit hippy dippy when you're talking like this, but it is so true. And yes. You take, like, just like we talked about earlier on, about trying to see the silver lining and everything and retraining your brain. Like, I don't, like, there's a lot of people in certain groups will say, you know, you have to get down on your knees and you thank God for a sober day. No, you don't. You lay in bed and you think, oh my God, I'm so lucky to have such a comfy bed, and so don't want to get out of bed. Yeah. You know, it's, you look at for the silver lining all the time. You force yourself to find the joy in the little moments that ultimately you've been missing. And it's really just that's adding the layer and the layer and the layer on that foundation. And that's what brings us to the point that we're at now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's all interlinked, isn't it? The confidence thing and the, you know, all of that stuff, it's all interlinked. And we ultimately come out at the other end far stronger than we were when we went in.
So
I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. It's rebuilding yourself.
It is. And it is cliche, but it really is the gift that keeps on giving. So, you know, yeah, it's brilliant. So in terms of your top three tips, what would you share the listeners to help them on their journey, especially if they're early in their journey? What would you recommend?
So the first thing I would suggest is be absolutely kind to yourself, because it is not easy. Nobody will know how difficult it is apart from you. So it's be kind to yourself. So really and truly, the self-care thing that has to, you know, buy the new pajamas, eat the damn chocolate. You know, forget about diets, eat the chocolate. If it's going to get you through an evening where you get a little bit of joy out of that sweetness of the chocolate, allow yourself the chocolate. That's tip number one, because what you're about to do is life-changing, and don't underestimate it. The second tip that I would say, and it's one that people would not be very fond of, I wasn't very fond of it. It was uncomfortable, really uncomfortable, but you have to do it if you're serious, and that is tell other people. Tell your family what you're trying to do, because you are going to need, it's not that you need monitoring, but it's so much easier if they know you're trying to give up alcohol and you're struggling with it. The only way they can help is if they know. Keeping it to yourself, it's just making it harder on yourself. Sometimes just telling somebody else, oh my God, I could just really kill for a glass of wine right now. And that if they just empathize with you, it can help just eliminate that craving and you get through another evening. In all my relapses, it was because I wasn't honest with the people around me. I never told them when I was craving. So, you know, it's just the truth is in front of us. You know, if you tell people, it helps. And then I suppose the thing about it is, as drinkers, if we think about all of the energy that we put into planning our drink, buying our drink, sitting and drinking our drink, and then that effort that takes to revolve around it, which we all do, regardless of whether it's just a glass of wine in the evening or whether it's three bottles of wine in the evening, there's an effort, there's a focus. It's all that effort that you put into getting that drink. If you decide that you're not going to, take that effort. You've got that energy somewhere. Take that effort into staying well. So put it into something else. Put it into, well, this evening I'm not going to have my bottle of wine, so what am I going to do? I'm going to spend £5 on a really nice essential oil for my bath. I'm going to make my bath special. This kind of, you know, it's choosing to do something else, but put the same amount of energy and stop thinking that you're depriving yourself. You're not. What you're doing is actually you're choosing something else, and you're not going to be depriving yourself. You're actually going to be, it's something better for you. I think it's, what is it? People say, try not to think of it as that I'm taking something away, but that I'm doing something good for myself. As you know, it's flipping it on its head and looking at the joy that you can potentially get out of it, and then try and enjoy the experience, because it is, like you said, it's the gift that keeps on giving. We could talk all day about the different things that come from it, but look after yourself, tell other people, and, you know, don't worry about the chocolate. Eat the damn chocolate. Eat the chocolate.
Eat the chocolate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had the chocolate before I even clicked record on this podcast. So I had to
say, First 2 months for me, I could have opened a branch in Cadbury's. I was just, it was. And like my partner, he's great, but he would look at me and say, "You're having another bar of chocolate." I'm like, "Leave me alone. Leave me alone." if you need a crutch through that first month, just do it. Yeah. Or if it's cake or if it's sweets, whatever it is, diets can come later.
Exactly. You know,
just get yourself through the first period of time.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Where can we find you, Katrina? If people want to reach out and just send a little message, like how can people find you?
Yeah, so I've got a Facebook page. I'm not on Instagram. I'm probably one of those really weird people that is not on Instagram. I am on Facebook. My name is Katrina Byrne. So you can reach out. You can reach out to my profile if you need any advice, if you just want to chat. I'm absolutely there. I'm happy and comfortable in a place now where I do actually feel like I have useful tips for people who are going through it, because I've been there and I've done that. So I would welcome anybody who wants to have a chat, or indeed if they just, you know, want to connect and let me know how they're doing. So that's how they can get me on Facebook.
And just spell that for me, just so that people, because I imagine there may be a few Katrina Byrne. So how do you spell it?
So it's Catriona. So it's the Irish spelling, and then Byrne is Byrne.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and huge good luck for your 1 year Soberversary.
Thank you.
Must be coming in a couple of months in around Easter time.
Absolutely.
Great celebration planned. It's such an achievement. It's such a huge achievement, and you've done amazingly well, you know, to go from that dark place that you were in. Yeah, you have so much to feel proud of, and I'm really glad you do feel proud, because you absolutely should. So all the very best, and please stay in touch. And I'm sure our paths will cross again.
Thank you very much. Thanks a million, Terry.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.